So it's 9:15. Can everybody hear me? Guess we can get started.
Yes, we can.
Great. So good morning, everybody. I just take a brief moment to introduce myself since I'm not necessarily new to the group, but new to presenting here. My name is Scott Asif. I am currently with the Mayo Clinic group here in Florida. And I have met a lot of you, worked with some of you as well. I was a fellow back in 2015, I believe, up in Rochester. And I've since been at the University of Wisconsin and then Cleveland Clinic prior to coming here in Florida. So this are the articles for 2022 December. There weren't really a whole lot of articles that I found. They were certainly interesting, but not that many that I thought were necessarily groundbreaking. But the four that I'm going to talk about, I kind of clustered them together for a reason and kind of get the sense of what may be happening in the field of early stage lung cancer and sort of get a sense of what the group has experienced in terms of their practice. So the articles are all uploaded in Dropbox. There's a PDF that has individual links to the papers that you can assess them directly. So the first one is in the Journal of American Journal of Surgical Pathology. It's a group out of China where they're using the IASLC proposed grading system from back in 2011. And they aim to validate the prognostic performance of the system and explore its role in guiding the strategy for lymph node dissection. So they retrospected, these are all retrospective studies. So that's kind of the one weakness that will sort of recur here. They looked at about 1,000 patients with clinical stage one lung adenocarcinomas who underwent surgery between 2011 and 2013. And basically what they did was took the grading scheme, grade one being lipidic predominant tumors with less than 20% of a high-grade pattern, grade two, acinar papillary predominant tumors with less than 20% of a high-grade pattern, and then grade three, any tumor with 20% or more of a high-grade pattern. And they looked at whether or not there was a correlation between the grade and whether or not the patients had pathologic evidence of nodal disease. What they found was the differences in prognosis between all the neighboring grades were highly significant based on the grading system. They found that almost no grade one lung cancers had N2 disease, whereas not unexpectedly, rates were higher in grade two and grade three. Interestingly, this also seemed to correlate pretty well with the preoperative clinical staging. So whether or not, they don't really go into whether or not that biased to what degree the surgeons sampled mediastinal nodes. What I did find interesting, but they unfortunately didn't go much further into it, was they mentioned the overall accuracy of using intraoperative frozen section to identify the IASLE grading system. And they say that they were pretty accurate when they compared it to the permanent sections. What they don't really go into is how much of the tumor they actually put through at frozen section, whether it was all of it, whether it was just a sampling, and then what the correlation between the frozen section and then the permanents were if or when the entire tumor was put through. And ultimately, they conclude, not totally unexpectedly, that the grading system could accurately stratify prognosis and predict mediastinal nodal metastasis in patients with clinical stage one lung adenocarcinomas. My interest in this was more so for the frozen section aspect of it, which unfortunately they did not go much into. And as far as discussion, what I would ask the group is, I think there's a smoldering curiosity or perhaps a need going forward, or in that I've been approached by a couple of surgeons asking at frozen section, asking afterwards about what patterns I was seeing. And this will come up in the next paper as well. I don't personally report patterns at frozen section, but I think they're becoming savvy enough to know that things like micropapillary or solid growth have a prognostic implication. And that is kind of a segue. And I think I'll present the four papers and then we can sort of chat about the implications afterwards. So the second paper here is, again, it's another group out of China. And this is out of thoracic and cardiovascular surgery. So it's lacking, unfortunately, in a whole lot of pathology. But again, I think it's this trend of sort of the shifting dynamics in terms of how they clinically and surgically treat early stage lung adenocarcinomas. And this one's pretty brief. It's again a group out of China, 10-year follow-up of lung cancer patients with resected adenocarcinoma in situ or minimally invasive adenocarcinoma. And essentially what they did was, again, retrospectively, they looked at about 2,000 patients with lung adenocarcinomas. And then they do what they say is enrolled 53 adenocarcinoma in situ and 72 with minimally invasive adenocarcinoma for analysis. And essentially what they mean by analysis is I guess they followed up with these individuals at about 10 years or 111 months. And what they found was for these cases of in situ or minimally invasive adenocarcinoma, at least for the 125 patients that they looked at, there was a recurrence-free survival was 100%, and the 10-year overall survival of adenocarcinomas in situ and minimally invasive adenocarcinomas were 98 and 97%, respectively. They found no difference in the 10-year recurrence-free survival between patients who underwent lobectomy versus wedge resection, which is interesting because that's sort of a segue into the last article, I believe. And they found that the risks of developing second primary lung cancer for adenocarcinoma in situ and minimally invasive disease were relatively low, 8% and 4% respectively. And they found no correlation with EGFR mutation status. Now, again, this was a retrospective study. They don't go too far into the pathology in terms of, again, how much of the tumors they submitted, whether or not this was they mention it here that frozen sections were done on these tumors, but they don't mention whether or not the intraoperative consultation played any role in terms of the surgical management or whether or not any of that was reported. I highly doubt that it was because as they mentioned, their cohort sort of predates the grading system that we were discussing in the earlier paper. But ultimately they conclude that adenocarcinoma in situ and minimally invasive adenocarcinoma have no recurrence during 10-year follow-up. And they say regardless of surgical type, their focus here was on the wedge resection and this notion that patients with in situ disease or minimally invasive disease, wedge resection or segmental resections may be enough for them. And again, this is an issue that has come up for me personally in terms of surgeons asking at the intraoperative consultation whether or not we think it is a minimally invasive disease or in situ. At present, we're not freezing the entirety of the tumor. I think that would be necessary in order to answer those types of questions. But again, I think that our surgical colleagues are becoming savvy enough that this is information that they may want to know at some point in order to guide both the resection and possibly the lymph node dissection. At present time, there are no guidelines as far as surgery is concerned in terms of whether or not we say it's invasive or in situ in terms of how much they're going to do with regard to resection and lymph node dissection. All right, the next one here I found interesting. Again, it's all the spectrum of sort of low stage, lower grade lung adenocarcinomas and how sort of going forward we're going to treat these. So this is a group out of Europe, and what they looked at was the prognostic impact of tumor mutational burden in resected stage 1 and 2 lung cancers. This tumor burden is an FDA-approved biomarker for use of pembrolizumab, which is an immune checkpoint inhibitor, as a monotherapy for various number of tumors, if the tumor burden rather is high enough. So this is what the authors are trying to do here is they're trying to get at whether or not for these lower stage lung cancers, tumor burden may be effective in predicting who will or who will not respond to early checkpoint inhibitor therapy as a monotherapy. And essentially what they did was next generation genomic profiling of a little more than 300 early stage lung cancers. And they looked at tumor mutational burden as well as microsatellite instability. And essentially what they found was that there was no significant prognostic impact in terms of predicting stage 1 or stage 2 lung cancers and outcomes for patients. And they, in this case, they looked at outcomes as well as nodal classification, but still found no significant difference, which I think in and of itself is interesting in that they had some with high tumor burden and some with low. And I think what this study would have benefited from, what I think all of these studies would have benefited from is if they were using information from one of the studies as well as their own study. So I'd be most curious to know in these cases what the histologic patterns were in the high tumor burden versus low tumor burden, and whether or not you could parse it out that way and whether or not you could make any correlations. But unfortunately, that was not analyzed in this case. And then lastly, again, aside from the tumor burden, I think most of what I'm presenting here is not necessarily new to the landscape in terms of how we have been defining and analyzing it. But again, I wonder if it will be changing sort of the landscape in terms of what we are reporting, both in our final reports as well as at intraoperative consultations. So lastly, in terms of the discussion, is a group out of Japan. This is in lung cancer. And they looked at spread through airspaces as a prognostic predictor in patients with resected stage 1 disease. Again, they're all of these manuscripts are looking at early stage lung cancers. Again, it's a retrospective study. They looked at 265 patients who underwent lobectomy with nodal dissection. They had 93 patients with sublobar resections, and ultimately stage one disease. And they looked at clinical variables, including CEA levels, tumor size, what they defined as the consolidation tumor ratio, which was calculated by dividing the consolidation size based on radiography by the total size and maximum SUV. And then they went through, obviously, histology results and noted the presence or absence of stas and lymphovascular invasion. So they had a median follow-up of 49 months. The overall survival for patients with stas was 92% at 3 years compared to 97 with no stas at 3 years. And ultimately, I mean, that's not a huge difference, but ultimately they conclude that stas as an independent factor was associated with postoperative recurrence after lung resection for stage one lung adenocarcinomas, and that among the stage 1A patients, the postoperative outcome of patients with stas were worse than those of stas negative patients and were similar to those of stage 1B patients. Now, again, I believe they mention frozen section. Somewhere in the discussion, I believe. But again, they make no point to say whether or not stas was commented at the frozen section or how that would have impacted the surgery or not. So I guess collectively, the papers were not groundbreaking, but I think they're beginning to highlight how our clinical colleagues are starting to recognize the significance of these nuances that we may or may not be reporting at the frozen section, but all ultimately in the final report. Again, the reason I brought this up is I've had conversations with surgeons and more recently with oncologists in terms of them trying to get a sense as to what it means to them when we mention things like a micropapillary growth component or a spread through airways. And that was the other thing in the spread through airways that I thought was slightly lacking. They again didn't go into what the patterns were that they were appreciating in the stas versus non-stas patients. One would presume that there was a higher degree of micropapillary growth in the stas positive patients, which, you know, in and of itself could also factor for the postoperative recurrence or the better outcomes of the patients who did not have micropapillary growth patterns. So I guess, discussion then for the group would be, has anyone else had any experience in terms of surgeons or clinicians asking or wanting to know more about these different variables and how it may impact their treatment? Like I said, I know at least, I know there's at least one group out there of cardiothoracic surgeons who are interested in this notion of sublobar or wedge resection for patients with in situ or minimally invasive adenocarcinoma. What I don't think they appreciate is the reproducibility or the difficulty in rendering a definitive diagnosis like that on frozen section versus the permanent sections. And I have also been asked about stas. To a lesser extent, though, I do not know how that information might impact surgery or treatment. And then as far as reporting the higher grade patterns, I've had conversations with oncologists, but again, I don't think it's yet made its way into changing anything in terms of what they do for management or post-operative surveillance. So I guess you can open it for discussion. There's some notable articles that I can touch on after we're done talking, because I would like to bring them to your attention. But anyone else have any experience with this, or are people reporting these things at Prose and Section? No? Okay.
Yeah, this is Jeff at Michigan. I don't believe we're being asked to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying I'm being asked to do it, but what I'm saying is it has come up in conversation where I turned to the surgeon and I said, well, what would that tell you if I told you it was in situ? And what they responded is, their response was, well, I might seriously take into consideration stop, because these were cases where it was a diagnostic wedge, and then they're looking for a diagnosis of cancer, and they're going to go back and they're going to do the lobectomy. And what they were saying is, if you tell me it's in situ, I might consider backing off and leaving it at the wedge, or just doing a segmentectomy if I can. Of course, a lot of this too is dependent on the location of the tumor. Not all tumors are going to be amenable, even if they are in situ disease, to a curative wedge resection. So,
yeah, Yasmin here, Arizona. I have not been asked this, and I personally would probably feel a little uncomfortable being asked to render a diagnosis of AIS or MIA on frozen. Mm-hmm. I think you would have to freeze all of it, and then you've frozen all of your tissue, and then I wonder how that might affect molecular. And then also, I mean, even, permanents after frozens don't look as good. I always find myself looking more towards the permanent sections that were not frozen in order to figure out, the best patterns, the best take on the pattern percentages. So I would not like the idea of freezing or lung tumors and having to do all that on frozen.
Yeah. And that's sort of the argument that, that was my counter argument, I guess, to that discussion. What I got in response, trying to explain to them that, I wouldn't want to freeze it all. It's going to, how's it going to impact downstream testing? And they were less informed about that aspect of the tissue processing, than why I couldn't just do it right there on the frozen section. So.
I think in Rochester for the MIA, AIS, lipidic stuff, they rely a lot on the imaging in terms of, pure ground glass opacities versus solid in terms of making their surgical decisions. So for example, even last week at the frozen section, this patient had multifocal lung cancer and the fellow was all confused because the surgeon was chasing a 1.1 centimeter nodule where on the other side there was a 2.5 ground glass opacity described, but the lesion they were chasing was solid and was higher grade in the end than the ground glass opacities that they left behind. So I think they rely a lot on the imaging to make their decision of how they're going to proceed. At one point, we did have a surgeon who really wanted to know about STAS. I don't know if there's been another study since Marcheski's study that kind of showed that really where STAS was maybe not reliably accessible on frozen, but there's not a lot of studies out there. So after a while, she dropped the topic. So we haven't been really asked too much about whether STAS is present or not in terms of them deciding what to do next. I think that's where we are at now. I don't know if Anya has other insight also.
No, I have the same experience as you, MC.
I think it's also a pretty low stakes distinction. There's no difference between in situ and minimally invasive, so that's a meaningless distinction. And at least in Memorial Sloan Kettering's data, if you had at least 50% lipidic, and nothing bad, no micropapillary, et cetera, that was statistically indistinguishable from in situ and minimally invasive. So, I mean, we're dancing on the head of a pin here for a distinction that is low stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wonder too, I mean, with the radiologic impressions of ground glass, I mean, I've seen cases come through where, you know, they're ground glass lesions and they're thinking it's going to be low grade and then it back as, you know, almost all micropapillary. So that's another thing to consider here.
I'm trying to pull up my PDF. I'm having a little bit, bear with me here just a minute.
Have they published the final results of the CALGB trial? I know it was taking forever to hit their endpoints, but I don't, has that been published of their less than lobectomy trial? I don't think so, right?
No idea.
Okay. I cannot seem to share my screen again. Give me just a minute. So, just a few others to bring to your attention here. These are the two that we reported, we talked about. These are the four, rather. There's an interesting paper here in Modern Path looking at PD-L1 expression and whether or not it changes if patients get neoadjuvant chemo or checkpoint inhibitor or other neoadjuvant chemotherapies in terms of expression. And they found that PD-L1 expression was mostly unchanged after chemotherapy compared to diagnostic biopsies. It was a relatively low sample size, but interesting nonetheless. They also found that there was a shift in the number of CEA positive T cells present within those tumors as well. There's another article in Modern Path. I thought this was a nice one. They defined the molecular and immunophenotypic characteristics of SMARC B1 or INI1 deficient thoracic neoplasms. I believe this is out of Memorial Sloan. I'm not entirely sure, but it's a nice paper. With some good morphologies. We had, at least in Cleveland, kind of routinely been doing INA1 and BRG1 or SMARCA4 stains on poorly differentiated lung tumors, not to define them as these SMARC deficient tumors, but rather to get patients into clinical trials that are targeting these SWE/SNF pathways. For non-neoplastic lung, this I don't think comes as any surprise to any of us. Oil red O staining of pulmonary macrophages and bronchoalveolar lavage is not specific for vaping associated lung injury. This was a topic of discussion a few years ago, sort of just before the pandemic began, whether or not we should be freezing and doing oil red stains on biopsies in order to define EVALI or vaping associated lung injury. I think most people agreed at the time that there really was no utility in this and that we were able to define histologically whether or not we thought that a biopsy might be vaping related. Oops, too far. And then in histopathology, this was a nice sort of comprehensive look at immune checkpoint inhibitor related pneumonitis. They go through both the pathology as well as the histology. Fairly comprehensive and a good read, I thought. Oh, and here, this was a great paper. I've already printed it out and it's tacked to my wall here. This one was out of folks up in Rochester as well as a group in Florida, updating normal organ weights using a large current sample database of nicely curated autopsy specimens. So thank you all for that. And then here, this, I was not aware of this policy, but this came out of thoracic and cardiovascular surgery as well. They looked at the outcomes of lung transplantation at a Canadian center using donors declined in the United States. So apparently, if lungs are declined by enough facilities here in the United States, they're actually offered to Canadian sites. And they compared these rejected US donor lungs to lungs that had been collected in Canada and looked at whether or not there were any differences in outcomes. Which I found this interesting because you're probably all aware of the lung rehabilitation work that's actually going on down here in Florida, but sort of originated up in Canada in terms of this ex vivo perfusion and ventilation that they can do in order to rehabilitate lungs prior to transplantation. And there were a few.
So can I ask, does that mean the bar is too high in the United States or too low in Canada?
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that question, but yeah.
It seems bizarre.
It is. Yeah, I was not aware of this policy.
So I was intrigued by this this article too. So what was their comparison? Was it their own lungs, which were,
I believe it was
kind of beautiful or?
Yeah. Let me take a quick look. I believe it was
Like they compared outcomes to those with donor lungs offered in Canada.
Yeah.
Right? Not.
Yeah. So they had recipients.
But they could have been equally as bad then, couldn't they?
Yeah. Oh, that's sure. What I'm wondering.
They very well could have.
But what was the outcome?
What the hell's going on up there, Marie Christine?
Yeah, I have no idea. We're just less high maintenance, I guess. But I guess what was the outcome? Did they do as well?
They said of these incidents.
Yeah, because if they do as well, I guess maybe.
Then that would say our bar is too high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They look at overall survival and what they call ex vivo lung perfusion. Yeah. I think it's just overall short and long-term outcomes or survival.
Yeah,
we're similar.
Between
the rejected.
Get you grit. Okay.
Between the rejected and the. I'm sorry, the US rejected and then the
Canadian lungs. Yeah.
Mm. This was an editorial on a larger article, which was interesting, looking at allograft dysfunction and whether or not so-called microaspiration may be playing a role in allograft dysfunction. I thought this was interesting just because microaspiration or GERD, or whether or not you believe in it or not, and what role it may be playing in other forms of interstitial lung disease and not just allografts. But I tend to believe it may be significant more so in allografts because those patients lose the cough reflex and are more likely to not only microaspirate, but have particulate type aspiration as well. And then there are a few case reports, but not a whole lot for whatever reason in December. And that is all I have to present. If there's anything else folks would like to talk about, but thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Scott. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you as well.
Nice to see you again.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Scott, is it okay to send this to the PPS?